Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're taking a look at the economy, but maybe not in the way you'd expect. We're going right to the foundations of economic thought.
We are. The source material for this deep dive is called From Money Growth to Life Coherence, and its mission is, well, it's pretty challenging.
How so?
It's unpacking a framework that makes a really radical claim that orthodox economics isn't just, you know, biased or flawed, but that it's an incomplete science.
Incomplete.
Right. That it has failed at a structural foundational level, which means it literally cannot tell the difference between real success and just, well, systemic self-consumption.
Okay. That is a huge claim to start with. An entire field missing its first axiom. So what's the core diagnosis here? What's the central failure they're pointing to?
It all centers on something they call the proxy error.
The proxy error.
Yeah. The idea that mainstream economics optimizes a symbolic proxy, so things like money, GDP growth, short-term profit, instead of optimizing the actual real-world life support conditions that all those symbols depend on.
Okay, let's unpack that right away. Because the outcome they're describing is, well, we see it everywhere, don't we?
I think so.
Monetary growth, GDP, corporate profits, they all routinely rise. But at the same time, we see ecological depletion, public health declining, social resilience fraying. The claim here isn't that this is a bug, but a feature of a scientifically broken theory.
Precisely. If your theory says success, while the very foundations you need for that success, clean air, stable climate, healthy people, are getting worse, then the theory itself is wrong. It's optimizing for the wrong thing right from the start.
So over the next few minutes, we're going to dissect how this error shows up in the real world, introduce the missing piece, what the sources call the life value, onto axiology, and then explore how to rebuild concepts like capital and efficiency.
And rebuild them into a life-coherent science.
Exactly. So let's start with the basics. What makes a science a science? What criteria is economics supposedly missing?
Right. So any mature science, whether it's physics or biology, needs four non-negotiable things. First, a clearly defined state space. The variables that describe the system.
The things you measure.
The things you measure. Second, units that actually correspond to real properties, not just abstractions. Third, you need invariants or constraints, you know, laws that can't be broken.
Like the laws of thermodynamics.
Exactly. And finally, and this is a crucial one here, a correct objective function for the system you're modeling.
And the argument is that orthodox economics falls at the first hurdle. It commits this proxy error.
It does. It confuses the symbol for the reality. It substitutes the variables of a coordination system, money and price, for the variables of the life provisioning system itself.
I mean, money is a fantastic tool for coordination.
It's an incredible tool, but it's a means, not an end. You can't eat it, you can't drink it. Its value is completely contingent on the physical and social life support infrastructure that stands behind it.
It reminds me of that old joke, you know, if a physicist tried to model a human body by only tracking the money circulating inside it instead of its metabolism, they'd be laughed out of the room.
Of course.
Yet we seem to do that for our entire economy. We treat the circulation of financial symbols as the main indicator of health.
And because the system treats individual preferences as totally sovereign, it doesn't matter if those preferences are based on need or, you know, desperation or advertising, price becomes the only measure of value. So you end up optimizing the circulation of symbols, not the health of the life support systems.
And the most famous symptom of this, the one that makes headlines every single year, is the GDP paradox.
Right. Gross domestic product. It measures the volume of transactions, which seems okay on the surface.
But this is where it gets really strange and, frankly, a little disturbing. It doesn't distinguish between activities that create life capacity and those that just compensate for its destruction.
Let's use an example because this really shows the failure mode. Imagine a huge oil spill. It destroys a coastal ecosystem. First, GDP rises dramatically from all the cleanup contracts. Then the public health crisis from the pollution requires massive healthcare spending. That's more GDP growth. Then maybe the government militarizes the oil route to prevent future disruptions. All that defense spending also gets added to GDP.
So a single act of destruction, the spill gets multiplied into three different rounds of what we call economic growth.
Exactly. The system registers the damage and the compensation for the damage as a net positive. All while the actual life support capacity of that region, the ecology, the human health, has plummeted.
A metric that goes up while the conditions of life go down is, well, it's scientifically invalid.
It's not a measure of economy, which literally means household management. It tells you a foundational constraint is missing.
Which brings us to this missing axiom. If the current model's broken, what's the constraint we need to bring in to make economics a complete science?
The necessary constraint is what the framework calls the life value onto axiology, or LVOA for short.
Life value onto axiology. Okay, that's a mouthful.
It is, yeah, but think of it as the equivalent of the laws of thermodynamics for physics. It's the primary axiom of value for any science that deals with living systems.
But wouldn't critics say that defining value objectively is impossible? That you're immediately getting into subjective ethical claims, not scientific ones?
That's a crucial question. And the answer, I think, is in how it's structured. LVOA defines value based on the functional prerequisite for life itself. It's not a preference.
Okay, so how does it define it?
It's very simple. Value is defined by the expansion of coherent life range. Disvalue is its contraction. That's it. It's an objective fact about whether a system is viable or not.
Tell us more about life range. What are the components of that?
It's broken down into three fields that have to work together. Thought so, cognitive capacity, learning. Felt, being, sensory capacities. Emotional health, freedom from pain. And action, your ability to move, to participate.
Thought, felt, being, and action.
Yes, they're universal. Every living thing, and so every society, needs capacity in these dimensions to survive, let alone flourish.
So if something enhances your ability to think, feel, and act coherently, say, a good education or clean air, that's value positive. Doesn't matter what the price is.
Exactly. And if something reduces that capacity through pollution, poverty, chronic illness, that is disvalue. It doesn't matter how profitable the activity causing it might be.
This is the non-negotiable constraint.
It has to be. If a corporate profit conflicts with life range enablement, that profit is objectively diseconomic.
So this requires a complete recalculation of what an economy's variables even are. If it's not money, what should we be measuring?
The economy is, at its base, a life support provisioning system. So the universal human life necessities become the true economic state space. They replace abstract things like prices and money flows.
So we're talking about things like
breathable air, clean water, nourishing food, shelter, healthcare, education, but also meaningful work, ecological integrity, social inclusion. The real condition of the economy is the sufficiency level of these things.
Not its price vector.
Not at all. If people are systematically deprived of any one of these life range contracts, it doesn't matter how high the average income is.
And this leads to a huge shift away from the standard measure of willingness to pay, which is really just what people can afford.
To a measure of sufficiency, and that is the dividing line. Prices tell you what people can afford within the existing power structures. They're transactional.
But sufficiency asks a different question.
It does. It asks, is the water clean enough to be healthy? Is the food nourishing enough? Is the shelter safe enough? The measure is independent of the market price.
So a true science of economy can't confuse market scarcity with actual value.
Or treat human deprivation as just another form of demand. And this is how you get a new definition of development. It's not transaction volume anymore.
It's the expansion of secure access to life goods.
Across the entire population and through time. So if GDP goes up but access to clean water goes down, that society is scientifically regressing.
This is a radical shift in how we see wealth. If the current system optimizes for liquidation, we have to redefine capital. What's the difference between life capital and false capital?
Life capital is any form of wealth that produces life goods and sustains itself without loss in cumulative yield over time. It's inherently regenerative.
So things like healthy forests, wetlands, clean water sources.
Yes, but also public health systems, education systems that build human capacity, social trust, resilient infrastructure.
Yeah.
These things compound life.
And what about false capital?
False capital is anything that claims to be capital but generates monetary returns by consuming or degrading those underlying life conditions.
Reviewable.
Think of financial speculation that's totally detached from production.
Mm.
Or extractive industries that strip mine resources and don't restore the ecology. Orthodox accounting fundamentally mistakes this consumption, the liquidation of real assets for prosperity.
It registers the monetary gain but ignores the life capital depletion that paid for it.
Exactly. If we applied that kind of life coherent accounting, a lot of what's on corporate balance sheets today would look less like an asset and more like a massive systemic liability.
And a huge casualty of this misclassification is the civil commons. Things we often dismiss as just public expenditures.
Like public water, education, the legal system, environmental protections.
But the framework in our sources insists they are much more than that.
They're the primary economic infrastructure. They are the carriers of life capital that enable universal access and secure the conditions for all market activity to even happen.
They aren't externalities.
They are the baseline, the necessary conditions. So when we erode the civil commons through privatization or austerity, that's not just a fiscal choice. It's a direct, measurable contraction of the economy's life capital.
Right. Markets can't function without an educated population or a stable ecosystem. So when a company's profit margin goes up because they externalized pollution...
Yeah, they're destroying the base layer of the entire economy. Which brings us to efficiency. Standard economics is all about monetary efficiency, cost minimization, profit maximization. But this framework introduces three necessary efficiencies that have to improve together for an activity to be truly economic.
What are the three?
First is ecological efficiency, providing life goods with less waste, less pollution. Second is physical input-output efficiency, using less material, energy, and labor for the same output. And third, human development efficiency, the expanded life range and health of the people involved.
Okay, let's apply that. Think about a global fast fashion company. They might be incredibly high on monetary efficiency, cheap labor, fast output, huge profit.
But that activity almost certainly fails the life coherent test. It gets high profits by failing ecological efficiency, think of the textile waste, the pollution, and by failing human development efficiency, with poor labor conditions that contract the life range of workers.
So if it fails even one of the three, it's scientifically inefficient and diseconomic no matter what the stock price is.
That's the test. If an activity increases profits while liquidating life capital in any of those three domains, it's a structural failure.
And that, they say, is the core pathology of our current system. It's just optimizing the money sequence.
A relentless drive for monetary expansion for its own sake. It's an accounting logic that's internally coherent, but it's totally unconstrained by external, real-world life requirements. It can keep functioning in the abstract, even as it liquidates the physical conditions of its own reproduction.
Which has to change how we view risk. We're currently obsessed with financial volatility, interest rates, market crashes.
But the real systemic risk is a life capital deficit. It's the silent, slow erosion of our ecological, health, and social foundations.
The things we don't measure.
Right. When agricultural soil degrades or healthcare capacity is hollowed out, the financial instruments might still trade just fine, but the real economy has lost its ability to handle shocks.
And if you don't measure the deficit, failures look like they come out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Crises seem like black swans.
But they're not. They are endogenous. They're the result of decades of life capital drawdown that the system never accounted for. And that's why regulation focused only on finance so often fails.
Because it's treating the symptoms.
It's treating symptoms while the underlying disease, the liquidation of the civil commons, just continues. Because profit maximization is still the unchallenged goal.
So how do we turn this into therapeutics? What are the key corrections for policy and finance?
The first step is the big one. You have to rewrite the objective function of public policy. The goal has to shift from maximizing transaction volume to maximizing secure access to universal life necessities across generations.
And to do that, you need new metrics.
You absolutely do. We'd need mandated life goods sufficiency accounts, tracking real things, nutritional adequacy, housing security, air quality, not just monetary aggregates. And corporate and public balance sheets would have to explicitly separate life capital from false capital.
Force them to disclose the depletion of real capital. What about the financial sector? How do you constrain credit?
Any credit allocation has to be stress tested against the three efficiencies. Does this loan, this investment, demonstrably regenerate life capital? Does it improve ecological, physical, and human development efficiency?
And if it doesn't?
Then that credit is economically illegitimate under a life coherent science. Prudential regulation has to be grounded in life capital adequacy, not just financial capital.
The power here seems to be that it isn't about abolishing markets or finance. It's about completing the science. So they're forced to serve a purpose that's actually grounded in life support.
It corrects their governing objectives. The choice here isn't about ideology. It's about a responsibility to scientific truth.
Which brings us right back to the core takeaway. The central demand of this whole framework is that the discipline governing life provisioning must finally be answerable to life. The conclusion is pretty stark. An economics that can grow while destroying the conditions of life is not a science of economy.
Indeed. And a final thought for you, the listener, to take away. If profit maximization is, as this framework suggests, fundamentally liquidating the foundations of the economy, think about our current focus on financial regulation. How much of that regulation today is just optimizing the rate at which we consume our own life capital? The choice to measure what truly matters might be the only way forward.